And Justice Stacy will be rejoining us here. And with that, we may proceed. Garland?
Yes, it is.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. May please court. Mr. Chief Justice, my name is Corey Garland. I represent the appellant's matter, Union Pacific Railroad Company. The appellee in this case, Mr. Dan Anderson, was injured on October 2nd, 2007, when the Cherry was sitting on while at work for Union Pacific, flashed from underneath him, causing him to injure his low back. As a result of the incident and injury, Mr. Anderson filed suit, and the jury returned a verdict on his behalf and awarded him $920,000 in damages, $266,000 that being medical bills and medical expenses. Your Honor, Union Pacific did not receive a fair trial in the district court. In my limited time before the court today, I'd like to discuss or focus on three rulings that the district court made that are representative of the unfair prejudice that Union Pacific faced in the trial. First is the trial court's decision to allow the appellee, Mr. Anderson, to find evidence of his medical bills or expenses at trial. Conversely, the trial court's decision then to preclude Union Pacific from putting on like evidence of the amount of medical bills paid on his behalf. Secondly, the inability of the trial court, the inability of the Supreme Court here today to conduct a meaningful review of the record on appeal because of the loss of portions of the trial court record from below. And thirdly, the trial court's decision to allow argument and instruction of the jury on a theory of negligence, counting raise-ups.
Counsel, on the raise-ups issue, you claim that the jury instruction overall, when it's important to create an inconsistency of confusion for the jury. What do you have to show us today to establish that, other than just telling us to believe that?
Well, the jury.
You have to show our.
Well, the jury instruction. Well, firstly, it's the trial court's duty for the city to instruct correctly on the law. If you look at the instruction and the definition of res ipsa, in the instruction it states, and I'm not saying it's debated, but it states essentially that you can only find res ipsa. You can only go to res ipsa if the plaintiff could not prove specific acts of negligence.
But counsel, that was in the statement of case section, the actual elements section of the jury had fine, the working elements did not have that statement.
Well, it was still in the jury instruction, and if you read the jury instruction verbatim, that portion of the jury instruction, the statement of case is still telling the jury that you cannot find that the plaintiff proved the specific acts of negligence, then only then can you rely on a raised ipsa theory.
Do you agree that the element section is correct or not?
Well, the element section, we shouldn't even get to the element section because under this court's ruling in Stallmacher, once a plaintiff has argued specific acts of negligence, as was the case here, and offered expert testimony thereto, and the reason for the injury or the incident was established and agreed to by both parties, the breaking of the bolt, then res ipsa is inappropriate. And res ipsa instructions, then, the court should follow this court's precedent in Stallmacher and Long, precluding a res ipsa instruction. And in fact, there was nothing to prohibit the court from doing that. Res ipsa is a circumstantial rule of evidence, and the Eighth Circuit has clearly said that. Donnelly and Ramser, thus it's a rule of evidence, not a substantive law. And if it's a rule of evidence, then you follow the state court rule, which here in Nebraska specifically precludes that installment. So we shouldn't have got to that issue. Both instructions on the specific acts and res ipsa precluded the raise if said instruction from being given, which shouldn't have been given.
And I understand that you alleged it was given, but it was given. One of the elements that were given, correct?
The fourth element, the absence of an explanation by Union Pacific, I think inappropriately shifted the burden. It's the plaintiff who had the burden.
Didn't the judge tell the jury from that instruction that Mr. Anderson has to prove by great weight of evidence all of the following, and he lists 1, 2, 3 and 4 with the absence of explanation? So wouldn't that actually mean Anderson would based on the judge?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I still think it impermissibly shifted the burden to Union Pacific, absence of an explanation by Union Pacific. So I think that was confusing to the jury, much in the same way the instructions were in full when we tell the jury you cannot find, or you can only apply res ipsa if you cannot find the plaintiff who specific acts of negligence. And I think we can't ignore that inconsistency in the instruction. But I think the jury was confused because they found that, well, they found for the plaintiff on both counts, the specific act and res ipsa, when the instruction says you can't find, you can't consider res ipsa unless the plaintiff cannot prove the specific act and negligence. So I don't think we can ignore the fact that what the instruction said is that even though the verdict director or the element said res ipsa, the instructions were inconsistent and they're like confusing and I'm very prejudicial to Union Pacific.
And we have a special verdict form so that we know how the jury responded to those two specific acts versus res ipsa.
We do. We had the jury found them both counts. They found that Union Pacific was liable for a raise of sudden negligence and the specific acts in both counts, which is inconsistent, again, to the totality of the jury. Moving to the medical evidence of medical records, Union Pacific objected to the medical evidence, the evidence of medical expenses coming in before the jury because they were irrelevant. They were irrelevant because medical expenses were paid by Union Pacific pursuant to the Health and Welfare Agreement of 1975, and like a bargaining agreement that made a part of, pursued it into collective bargaining agreement. Thus, if Union Pacific had already paid the medical bills during the trial, then they were irrelevant. And their introduction in there became unfairly prejudicial. Well, they shouldn't be used. I think courts have specifically indicated that medical bills shouldn't be used in terms of, calculating the cost of the economic damages shouldn't be used in calculating the compensatory damages for pain and suffering damages. You do? But the damages aren't. Your Honor, I don't believe so in terms of significance would be the testimony of the plaintiff, the testimony of the plaintiff's treating physician, and in this case, the plaintiff's girlfriend also testified to his condition in terms of what the injuries caused.
You referenced the labor agreement. What impact on our, as a teleport, what impact would it have on the union's case that the labor agreement did not come in during trial, but only came in during the motion to give you a credit? How would that come in?
Well, the court wouldn't allow that testimony to come in. It would come in through Mrs. Broad and my impression statement. I think the court should still look at the document in terms of the policy implications that spring forward from.
How do we look at something that's not part of the record?
Well, it was made part of the record in the hearing on damage.
Well, yeah, that's not during the trial. The trials where the judge had to make that determination. recommendation on lighting and setting. So, what do we do?
I think the court should still look at the record in total for the section and the lower stuff. Then if they hearing on damages, they can carry the document.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Long?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Kyle Long, we're our Republican Block Group on behalf of the appellee, Dan Anderson. In this case, the defendant has failed repeatedly to preserve several of the issues that it is now arguing for and has failed to advocate for them at the trial court, and now asks this court to take up the mantle for it. When we look to the question about res ipsa, I think we first have to approach the threshold analysis of what were the allegations and negligence in this case, because much of the defendant's argument, appellate argument, is focused upon the fact that the appellee raised specific acts of negligence at the trial below.
When we also, when I don't want to interrupt you, but opposing counsel says that for them to find negligence, they have to have to find a specific act that caused the negligence, whereas our presence is not. And therefore, the system jury should stop this after negligence not going on. What's your response to
that? My response to that, Your Honor, is that what we were dealing with here are actually general acts of negligence, which were alleged in the elements. If you look to the jury, if you look to the jury instructions, the elements of specific acts or the acts that were alleged were general acts. It's consistent with the case law in the res ipsa appeal of cases that we cited in the brief.
None of those cases that are cited, both the dual instructions and the standard exception given, and they were always for this reason. Are you aware of a case in Nebraska where it's come up on the phone review where both negligence and race ipsa?
No, not in the state of Nebraska. In the FEMA cases, I'm trying to remember, I believe it was the Eighth Circuit case I know did cite, that was cited to, did approve of allowing both to sign at the same time. Third and Fifth Circuit have also approved. I don't remember what the instruction specifically reviewed in those cases were necessarily on point. The Third and Fifth Circuit cases that were cited in the brief also did approve of submitting the question to the jury of res ipsa with general negligence also.
Please, please, res ipsa is that something all of the theory is not a separate cause of action.
Your Honor, the pleading of res ipsa in this case was basically just brought on as necessity after the first pretrial hearing, in which the trial court was not identifying that what we were trying to point out was that in FELA, that res ipsa is a matter of substantive federal evidence law, in which we are applying that conclusion to it. Therefore, the court felt was necessary to identify it as a separate legal theory, which is why the complaint was later amended. The initial case. Exactly, Your Honor. And that was an issue that, to clarify, to make sure that we were going to have the issue presented to the jury, and we felt it was necessary to amend the complaint at late stage, you know, that was the theory we're offering to that case.
Those theories can be inconsistent if they are covering one, and they not cover the other.
That is correct, Your Honor. As for example, in this case, we were able to put forth a theory. The issue is that the bolt broke. We know the bolt broke because it suffered a fatigue fracture. Because it suffered a fatigue fracture, we know the chair was repeatedly overloaded beyond its design limitations. That's what we're able to prove, and that's what we're able to have expert evidence to show. Now, what was the source of the repeated overloading? One potential theory, and what we presented through fact witness testimony, that there were three employees who weighed over 300 pounds who used this chair on a repeated and ongoing basis. So as a result, That was one possible theory. That was one specific theory, as you're going to. No expert testimony was provided, but that was the only source. The res ipsa line follows because we have a chair that has been in service and used that, based upon expert evidence in favor of the appellee, had no design defect, had no material defect, had no manufacturing defect. There was no reason for this bolt to break. This chair had a 12-year warranty. It broke in less than 3 years. As the Union Pacific safety manager noted, this will happen if you overload a chair, if you abuse or misuse the chair. So we have to get to an explanation for the jury as to what actually caused that. That's why I think you can meet the elements of the specific acts of negligence in this case, because they were, it's actually general. as they were alleged. They failed to provide safe equipment. They failed to provide a safe workplace. You can meet those elements at the same time without describing exactly what was repeatedly overloading the chair while it was in the exclusive possession and control of the union. And that, I think, is the distinction in why raised lifts can be applied in this case with the, as the jury instructions are stated.
Do you think the jury then defined both theories? Because on the verdict form, they checked yes on check five.
I think it's very consistent that the jury finds in both theories, because what they found is that the act of negligence alleged was that they either failed to provide safe equipment or they failed to provide a safe workplace. We know what the cause of the injury is, which is the bolt breaking, and we know why the bolt broke, what it shows. We don't know what the specific act that was going on that caused them to provide the unsafe equipment, caused them to provide the unsafe workplace. We don't know what it is, but we know it happened completely within the control and supervision of the union.
The jury instructed that they could find one and not the other.
They were.
And they found both.
They found both.
And how does that not illustrate confusion?
I don't believe that it illustrates confusion because, as I was saying, you can come to that same conclusion by reading the instructions specifically. You can say that the union said it failed to provide an unsafe workplace. How are you getting to an explanation? That is identified in the case law that is identified in the brief. Those are general allegations of negligence in this case. Those aren't specific.
Either finding that recovery.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You didn't award two different sets of damage.
No, there was only one set of damages awarded, Your Honor. I don't believe there is prejudice, Your Honor. And to answer Justice Funk's question earlier regarding error in the jury instructions, there has to be a showing of actual prejudice when there is an error in the jury instructions, which has not been alleged and has not been shown. The appellant has never shown that the jury verdict was a result of passionate prejudice, and therefore, when it comes to the issue of errors in the jury instructions, when it comes to the issue regarding the improper argument, the issue, if we may quickly, of were the elements given correct in the jury instructions, especially as regards the fourth element. I believe we looked at Jesenowski, the U.S. Supreme Court case on Rays Lips, so we see that element regarding a lack of explanation, it was first cited by the U.S. Supreme Court when identified the Rays Lips claim, and therefore it is pulled forward, it is not shifted to the defendant, it's maintained in the jury instructions as the plaintiff's burden of proof. When we look to medical expenses, the medical expenses in this case are an economic damage that are recoverable by every legal action. The question is then, what is the interrelationship between the medical expenses and the offset provisions that exist under Section 5 of the FBLA covered by?
How do you justify your client getting an excess of $100,000 if you don't have
that? Well, Your Honor, I believe
it's not a general damage question. How do you justify?
Your Honor, I believe that the issue is that what is your damages that are recoverable, and is justified simply by following the law, saying his major damages are his reasonable medical expenses that actually incurred. There is a question about what is the function of the offset. When we look to the historic use of Section 5 pre-1975 agreement, we find that the FBLA was perfectly willing to say that if the employer had only paid insurance premiums on a policy, they were only entitled to an offset for the insurance premiums. They were only entitled for what they had actually paid for. And the FBLA was willing to accept windfalls in those scenarios until the 1975 amendment, the group plan was made to try to modify the situation to allow them to recover the full extent of the benefits that they had actually paid for. Now, the issue becomes, and I think this is in part because the nature of insurance law has changed so much since 1975.
Doesn't the labor agreement, which did come in and push credit, isn't it an attempt by union to set up insurance itself, so therefore in the law they should have pulled from it?
I believe that it is an attempt to make sure that they get credit for what they pay, but the issue is still, I think it's identified by this court in Strasburg, is that the issue still remains, what is what they are paying? And to the extent the benefits are provided, the extent the benefits are paid are the language from within that policy. And so we get down to the analysis then, is the write-off itself something that's being paid or is it an extra benefit that's being incurred?
How did your client ever incur those amounts? Your client never paid those medical amounts.
No, Your Honor. I can see that there were small things made by my client that he did not pay these medical amounts.
Like small, like $2,000?
A few thousand. And so, when you get to the question, I think that,
I mean, the way I heard you describe the element of damages was the specials actually incurred.
No, I do not disagree that he did not incur those damages. I do not disagree that he did not take, but he did incur that major of damages. And I think there's an issue about whether the 75 agreement has kept up with modern insurance law or modern insurance practice. Whereas I believe the 75 agreement doesn't, you don't have the world where you have this huge write-off that exists at the time the 75 agreement is drafted and has been allowed to continue functioning. The write-offs have become a major force within the insurance contracts, but the underlying document that authorizes the sell-off has not kept up with that, has not been revised to keep up with the advancing practices of insurance, and we're now at a place where, under the decision in Strasbourg, we have to try to square what happened in this case. And as in Strasbourg, at least for one instance regarding medical real estate, comes in only over a foundation objection, which was not been advanced and not been preserved on appeal. So we're facing a record in which we have an amount of medical bills that has been proven and shown that you have tried to decide.
Well, let me ask it a slightly different way. How would your client be prejudiced by Union Pacific being granted a full offset of the entire amount of medicals?
I think he's prejudiced by being denied what his right of recovery is. I mean, his right of recovery is the measure of the many more expenses that what it took to recover. The question of the offset, I think, is a separate analysis. The primary analysis is what were the value of the medical expenses that he received. The second step of the analysis then is the offset. And I don't think you take away the first element simply to get to the latter.
Isn't that converting economic damages into non-economic damages? Right? Because the economic damage was out of pocket. And he's not out of pocket.
Well, the economic damages are his economic loss, and the question is how do you,
he's not out of the loss.
But the question is how do you value the economic loss? If someone declares bankruptcy on their medical bills and has never paid their medical bills, we don't consider that. I mean, in the state of Nebraska, we have not considered that to wipe out necessarily the claims of the underlying expense.
Well, that's not a payment by the tort fees or as this arrangement is.
Agreed. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time? Do we have
He has 37 seconds left.
37 seconds, Mr. Garland.
I'll be brief. Your Honor, I'd like to direct the court's attention to CSX Transportation v. Williams, a Georgia case where evidence of medical bills was let in, but the court directed specifically that the railroad was to get full credit for the amount of medical bills awarded by the jury. And that prevents the double recovery, yes. And the second case would be Bryce versus that National Railroad Passenger Corp, wherein the court, again, the defendant was, once medical records were, evidence of medical expenses were put in, the defendant was permitted to put in evidence that it paid the medical expenses to the extent they were being claimed by the plaintiff. Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's 664 F sub 220, 1987. Both those cases were cited by the appellee in the
case. Counsel, 664 F sub what?
F sub 220, 1987. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go on to the next case of the day, which is Capertree. Corleone M. McCurry.